Welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Ian Rogers.
And this is Ian's first time on the show. He began as a fan, and now he is a co-host for the week. Welcome, Ian.
Woo! I'm excited.
And you should be, because this... I mean, we've had only had seven episodes, but I think we can all agree they've been spectacular so far.
Oh, absolutely.
End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and you can catch us here in our temporary home for the summer, Thursdays at 10 a.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the war drama Dunkirk. But that's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we are going to tackle some movie news from the past week, including Comic-Con. It's the biggest media event of the year, and it just wrapped up last weekend. And we are going to talk about who is it servicing, big media companies or fans, and what is the right answer. And then Christopher Nolan just released his new film, as we'll talk about later in the show, but he will never, ever work for Netflix. Is he the last standard bearer for the art form, or is he just denying the changing medium? But first, another anticipated movie coming out later this year, The Disaster Artist, based on the book of the same name about the making of The Room. And the first trailer was released last week. These kind of Hollywood satires, I think, kind of have to thread a delicate needle. They are either like too inside baseball, or they do manage to be appealing to both sort of movie fans, fans of the movie it's spoofing, and fans of just generally good cinema. So how familiar are you guys with The Room? I've seen The Room a couple of times.
I've seen it about twice, maybe three times.
Okay.
And I've done it sometimes in a group setting, but I've never done an official Spoon having screening.
Right.
I've never seen the film. I think it's a part of movie lore at this point. I think everybody kind of knows the story behind it, but I've never actually seen the film.
You think a lot of people know this? I mean, I do wonder if it's kind of niche-y. I mean, it's kind of like the Rocky Horror thing, right? A lot of people might have heard of Rocky Horror, but I do wonder how many people have gone to the trouble of actually watching Rocky Horror. I mean, they may be vaguely aware of the...
It's one of those, it's a cult. It's a cult hit.
Yeah, well, it's the epitome of cult classic. Anyway, one of the actors in it, Greg Sestro, he wrote a book called The Disaster Artist, and the rights were bought by James Franco, who is writing, directing, and starring in the film. And as I said, the first trailer came out. Unfortunately, can't play the clip because there's a bad word in it. I didn't have the time to download it and sort of blank out the bad word, which is said several times. But it is funny because it's sort of the key, the key scene a lot of people are familiar with. Have you seen the clips? I assume you've seen the clips on YouTube.
I've seen some, yes. Not recently. I didn't watch any of the clips in anticipation of the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember seeing them, yeah.
You remember, oh, hi, Mark.
Yes.
Anyway, since you've seen The Room, I'll go with your thoughts first on what, because the trailer is, and I may just put this on the website too, it's basically that scene and how they made that scene.
Yeah, I guess I thought I know some things about it. Like, I knew about the weird, the green screen that they show there is real, even though apparently they actually had a very nice view of the city.
Yeah.
But they wanted it to look more expensive. I don't know. but the 67 takes actually surprises me. I don't know if that's
true.
My instinctual reaction was like, oh, I would have seen him as the kind of person, because he wrote the movie, so you'd think that he would just take his own first take. But if it's almost more interesting if he actually did have that much trouble getting through these horrendously delivered lines.
Well, that's how it is in the book, and I mean, it could be debated, because there's like kind of multiple levels of reality, because there's Tommy Wiseau, who who is the director of the room and who the disaster artist is. He's a kind of the main character. He self-financed it. It was $6 million. He was the writer, director, producer. And yeah, instead of using the actual rooftop of the studio they were shooting in, he built a rooftop set with a green screen with a CGI background of the city.
So where did he get $6 million to make this film?
Great question. And it's, but it's, that, that's...
So did you read the book?
I've kind of made it halfway through the book before I had to put it down, and I've been meaning to get back to it, with the, especially with the movie coming out, but... I've made it through about where they are, have like sort of halfway through shooting the room.
Okay.
But yeah. The story is Greg Sestro, who plays Mike in the room, and is played by Dave Franco in the movie, which is another weird aspect of this movie. You have the brothers Franco playing different characters that are unrelated. But the story is that Sestro was doing acting classes in San Francisco with Tommy Wiseau, who was immediately terrible, and then they became friends, and then one of the plots of the book is this mystery of who is Tommy Wiseau, and how does he get his money, and where does he come from, and how old is he? and nobody knows. He's kind of this character, and it's either this act he puts on that he kind of lives in, like he's some kind of, I don't know, some kind of like...
alter
ego, yeah,
yeah.
Or he really is, you know, every inch kind of Mr. Mysterio he is. But it's fascinating, and I do wonder how much that will, I do wonder how much it will dig into sort of that aspect of who is Tommy Wiseau and how much of it is like, isn't it hilarious that they're making this terrible movie?
Yeah, I guess my fear is, I think with how funny the room and the story of the room is as a source material, mm-hmm. what I don't want is for it to just be another Seth Rogen, James Franco kind of goofy movie. Like,
yeah,
there's a level where it could be interesting if it's done with a sort of heart and a compassion for the source material, because Tommy was always somebody you feel kind of sorry for as you watch the movie in the real life. So I find that if it actually dives into that story instead of making it just complete screwball, goofball comedy, I think I would prefer that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I've always been curious, where did you see this movie? Do they screen it like in this city, or how did you get a hold of this film?
I saw it in Toronto.
Okay, so there was a screening there.
Yeah, it's like one of those midnight movie circuit things. I think they've done it at the Princess Twin a couple of times, or the Princess Theater in Kitchener as well. It kind of makes that round. But the one I was at was actually one where Tommy Wiseau was there.
Really?
And I actually got a chance to interview him. Unfortunately, I've lost the audio somewhere on one of my hard drives.
Oh,
but this is kind of where I'm curious about him. And I may not have been like a sophisticated interviewer as I am now, if I can call myself a sophisticated interviewer. But yeah, it does make me wonder, because talking to him, he's the character, or he is the character of Tommy Wiseau, or the character we're meant to think is Tommy Wiseau and not the real Tommy Wiseau. And along with that, though, is the question of, was this like a serious effort? Was this him making a movie to the best of his actual ability? Because he says now, oh no, this is exactly what I meant. It's like a spoof. It's a black comedy. It's like this melodrama thing.
Right.
And it's kind of hard to detect that. I think this was a genuine effort, but he likes playing this idea that he is this genius who like made this wonderfully subversive chamber drama that is bizarre and has characters named Chris R. in it.
So what is, like, just loosely, what is the movie about? Is it just about their kind of just hanging out?
Yeah.
And there is, no, like, I get the sense that there is no linear plot to it, that there's just kind of
one character
a conglomeration of scenes.
Yeah, one character gets cancer and it's never mentioned again.
Oh, okay.
I definitely have breast cancer.
I definitely have breast cancer. That's right.
Right. That's the kind of thing that you intentionally joke about, right, to make like a black comedy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. But it's
but Tommy Wiseau in the movie, whose character is named Johnny, which is such a, it's so close. And just everything about the way that he portrays himself in the film is this like very, very self-involved, narcissistic, convinced that he can't do anything wrong person, which right. is what makes me think that he is the kind of guy who, if people started saying, oh, if this is a great black comedy, he would go along with it. Mm. But I don't know. The way that the movie reads to me is as a genuine effort.
Yeah, and I would agree. To answer your question, though, the movie is about this guy, Johnny. He's, like, very successful. He has a beautiful fiance named Lisa. He has a best friend named Mark, and they all kind of hang out together. And it comes out that Lisa is cheating on him with Mark, and his life basically falls apart. But the whole thing is framed, and to play what you were saying about the narcissism, is that he's, like, this kind of innocent character who's, like, always helping out, and he's always, like, being a good friend, and... There's a I can't remember the character's name, but there's this younger kid who has some kind of mental retardation who he's kind of taken under his wing, and there's some bad stuff that happens with him, and in the end he's just like he's ruined because he finds out about Mark and Lisa, and that leads to the famous scene where he's like, I'm sick of this world, and he kills himself. Spoiler alert, but it's right. been out for 15 years, so it's.
I mean, I'm more interested in, I guess, now that you mention it, that he kind of flipped his opinion or his perspective. I would be curious to see how he changed after that movie. How did he? How was his character altered as a result of the success or, I guess, lack thereof? But certainly, like, financial success, I guess you could call it at this point. I mean, doesn't that thing sell out, like, every time it plays?
Yeah, or close to it. I'm not sure how well it does. I can't remember the last time it was screened in Toronto, but nor do I watch Toronto movie listings closely.
Right.
But, yeah, he's at least made that $6 million back because it was all self-distributed.
I would at least – I think I need to see the film before I see – The Disaster Artist. I know that sounds kind of common sense, but the genre of people like struggling to make a movie is a very like populated genre in cinema.
Yeah.
So I think there could be some enjoyment even without being familiar with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that Lost Souls movie that came out a couple of years ago about the Island of Dr. Moreau.
That's right.
And I hadn't seen the original Island of Dr. Moreau, and that's really, really great documentary. Mm-hmm. It's the B movie Hearts of Darkness.
Okay, say no more. I'm sold.
The Room is a movie that is worth seeing, but it's worth seeing like in a very casual setting around like it doesn't have to be that nice of a screen with a bunch of friends if you're not going to do the full Shazam. And I feel like if you're going to do that, you'd probably want to have seen it once already at your own.
So you can get all the nuances.
Yeah.
We'll move on to a different fan experience, which is San Diego Comic-Con. It happened this past weekend, and, you know, it made the usual kind of news items. I had to cover a lot of it for Nerd Bastards, but, you know, there were some big trailers and big reveals and big announcements. I think there's a sort of a perpetual question, though, is San Diego Comic-Con still for the fans, or is it more of a trade show now, where it's for the studios and TV networks to come and hawk their upcoming stuff? And to start off with Joanna Robinson, a writer I like very much, she writes for Vanity Fair. She wrote an article, "Have Fans Finally Won the War for Comic-Con?" And she points out to the fact that, you know, in terms of reveals, there's not too much. There's, like, celebrities there who give, like, pat answers because they don't want to reveal spoilers. Meanwhile, Comic-Con this year had, like, a ton of stuff that, including a Westeros experience for Game of Thrones fans, a Westworld experience, and a Blade Runner 2049 experience. So there's more stuff for fans to do that is only kind of translatable if you're there on the ground. But I gotta say, I am not convinced. As much as I would be interested in going to San Diego Comic-Con, because this is kind of my world, I can't think of a reason why I would actually bother to take the time and expense of a trip. It just seems... I mean, it's not even the corporatization of it. It's just, like, I don't want to wait in lines. I hate waiting in lines. It's, like, my pet peeve. Waiting in lines is the worst, and that seems to be what you do here is wait in lines. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I've never been to Comic-Con. It seems – I mean, I do – I used to, like, obsessively watch tech TV, and, of course, they would cover it every single year, and it always struck me as a fan – propelled event that seemed very obvious. I didn't know that it was there was like an encroachment on like trade shows and businesses and whatever. So that's interesting to me. Are you saying that they're trying to sell stuff, or are they trying to just promote their own, you know?
Well, I think what a lot of people are looking at is because for 30 some odd years, and I'll give you an example of it. Mile High Comics, which is a comic book store in Denver, Colorado, but it's so big that it's sort of known nationwide. They have been at Comic-Con every year since the beginning. They didn't go this year. So the one of the biggest comic book stores in the country didn't go to Comic-Con.
And that was out of protest for what it's become?
A bit of it, and a bit of it, the owner said it was logistics because he didn't feel like he was given, there was a matter of some mistreatment in terms of getting his stock to the floor. That he felt that, you know, he has this big multi-space booth for selling comics, and he felt the actual selling of comics at Comic-Con wasn't a priority anymore.
I could imagine the first thing that comes to mind is the fact that, like, Marvel movies and, to a lesser extent, the DC movies, Wonder Woman did well, have become the summer blockbusters of summer blockbusters. As far as I know, they're the films that make usually the most money, is these comic book films. And yep. So there's this aspect of whatever was used to be thought of as quote-unquote fan culture or nerd culture is now so lucrative and so mainstream that...
It's now culture.
It's just culture. So it's on a certain level, if I can imagine Marvel and DC both have huge, huge presences there, which, and, you know, there's a reason to think that, like, you know, they're going to do the same thing they do within their movies, which is try and advertise every single, you know, movie because they want you to go to all of them and to buy all the extra... you know, bobs and bins and toys and
it's I think one of the things I've been struggling with, and speaking of Marvel, they had their panel. It's kind of the Saturday night one that closes down the con for Saturday night. They had they talked about Thor, the new Thor movie, the new Black Panther movie, and then the Avengers, the new Avengers movie, and Ant-Man and the Wasp. But they did release a new trailer for Thor that they did show to Comic-Con, but then they had footage for Black Panther and Avengers that they didn't release. And then that's fine. And, you know, if you wait in line to get into this hall like people do for 18 hours, then, you know, maybe you should be showing these things. But there's another constituency who I think among them, who want to just stream it because it is, to get to your distinction, one is a fan event, where you get to go and you get to hobnob with the actors and the directors and the creators, and you get to get things signed and you get to, you know, collect things, whether it's posters or comics.
Right.
The trade show comes into it. It's like they're wanting to create buzz for these things, these products. And the way I phrase it sort of in my mind is, imagine going to a car show where they show you next year's cars, and you being a journalist on cars. They show you next year's cars, but you have to stand there and write down everything as they, all the amenities as they describe it at once, and then make that your article.
Right. Okay.
Instead of the car company saying, here are the specs, here's a picture of what the car is, and here's the concept, and here's the advertising materials. And it just seems like when they're, in terms of just covering this, that's kind of what they're doing for these Marvel movies. It's like, okay, instead of putting the clip online for all fans to enjoy, because I think there's a bit of classism here, because it's a huge expense to go to San Diego if you don't live in the area, because you have to pay an overpriced hotel, and pay for overpriced meals, and pay for an overpriced badge to get in. And it's all to, you know, stand there and wait in line to get into the hall and be there all day, so that at the end of the day you can see 2 minutes of footage rather than just sticking it online for everyone can see, no matter how they can, if whether or not they can get there or not.
It sounds like the consensus is that it's going in the wrong direction.
Well, that's my consensus, but I mean, one of the problems they have is, of course, pirating too, because of you know, little cameras you can hold in your hand and get good video
of the trailers. Right. Somebody did that, didn't they? Last year there was something, or maybe it was a couple of years back.
It happens almost every year. Something gets leaked.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, but anyway.
I mean, it's San Diego is obviously the biggest. Is it being held anywhere else?
Well, I mean, there's Comic-Cons everywhere, but I mean, in terms of, I mean, the biggest in North America, I think, are San Diego, New York, and Fan Expo in Toronto. But San Diego is the one where all this news kind of breaks.
Right, okay.
You know, it's definitely more, in so much as Joanna Robinson pointed out, there are fan things to do. A lot of attention is paid because that's where news breaks or where it's expected that news will break.
So are the fans, like, are they suggesting that it's becoming too corporate and too...
I think some people are.
Irrelevant, I guess?
I think some people are. I think Mile High Comics was certainly making that statement.
Yeah. I mean, it's never good when you get stuff like that happening.
Yeah. I mean, it was a comic, but of course, it's not just contained to the convention center anymore. And that was one of his arguments, too, is that it's also like around the convention center. It goes out for blocks now. I think it's the Gaslight District of San Diego that the convention center is at. And it's kind of that whole area. So imagine like someplace like the Ward here in Guelph. Mm-hmm. Imagine, you know, that getting taken over by a huge Comic-Con event.
That sounds
like a nightmare. You lit up.
Just like, I think that it's something about the nature of things like this that there's like a critical mass where you get to that point. Really, as a fan, I feel like I don't know. It's like with anything. Once it gets to a certain level of size, it's just like you kind of try and take from it what you can. But I can't imagine that you would want to, like, if you were just a person who was really into, like, I don't know, really into comic books as comic books, then you'd probably, I don't know, I feel like you wouldn't want to go to the giant San Diego Comic-Con, you know, again. You'd want to go to something a bit more niche-y.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and people would argue that that's where the real fan base is, the quote-unquote real fans, is, you know, people who know Ant-Man from the comics or what have you. Anyway, I want to get Vincent's opinion on this as a filmmaker too. Christopher Nolan was doing press for Dunkirk, and he was asked about making movies for Netflix, as a lot of people are kind of moving in that direction. And he said, and I want to quote him here, Netflix has a bizarre aversion to supporting theatrical films. They have this mindless policy of everything having to be simultaneously streamed and released, which is obviously an untenable model for theatrical presentation, so they're not even getting in the game, and I think they're missing a huge opportunity. And so when somebody just asked him bluntly, so like, would you work for Netflix? He said, no, well, why would you? If you make a theatrical film, it's to be played in theaters. So it seems like he is going the iconoclast route, even though you have people like Martin Scorsese. His next movie is going to be on Netflix, The Irishman, and it's no small movie either. It's
just like, sold for $100 million.
Yeah, and it's him reteaming with Goodfellas, De Niro and Pesci.
It's a very interesting... Let me just make sure I have this clear.
Mm-hmm.
Netflix both releases... and streams its stuff at once. So whereas Amazon, let's say, has it in theaters for 90 days and then it gets streamed online?
Correct.
Right. And Christopher Nolan obviously isn't a fan of Netflix's strategy.
Day and date is what it's called, yeah.
It's a very, very interesting topic. And I've been thinking about it actually a lot for the past few days. And I think...
we appreciate your efforts, by the way.
Well, I think it's because it's not black and white.
Yeah.
I don't think it's all good or bad. I find a lot of these filmmakers, and by these filmmakers, sorry, I mean the ones like Christopher Nolan that are extremely vocal about certain things.
Yeah.
Are not able to be objective about certain things. Like... It's like, okay, you're either with us on the 70mm thing or you don't love cinema. You're either with me on the Netflix thing or you're, you know, out in space.
Mm.
And it's like, well, it's not all good or bad, you know what I mean? It's like there are a lot of positive additions, I think, that are coming out of certainly the film argument. And
the reverse is true, too, though. You have people saying, like, get with the times, old man.
about Netflix. And
yes, and this is somebody who's self-proclaimed kind of, you know what I mean, doesn't use a cell phone.
Yeah.
Says, okay, if you want to get a hold of me on set, you know, there are tons of people around me. You can, they can reach out to me. Doesn't use email. Obviously has some issues with digital technology.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there is some kind of, I don't want to say technophobic, but technological bias on his part. Tarantino's another guy like that, you know what I mean? Has kind of an aversion to technology, you know, is always talking about, well, I don't know anything about the technical stuff, but I know what I want my film to look like.
Mm.
Was talking about, you know, using a typewriter back in the day. Just a guy that, you know, is obviously not into that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there is a bit of that kind of bias going on. But I have to say, in my personal opinion, I kind of agree with him. I kind of lean towards what he's saying. I don't think he's 100% right, but I do understand what releasing a movie in theaters does to the impact or to the artistic kind of integrity of that movie. But with that being said, sorry to cut you off. If a movie like War Machine had been in theaters for like 90 days before it went on to Netflix and I knew it was going to Netflix, I'm not sure I would have seen that in theaters, despite the fact that I really enjoyed that movie. I just don't know. That's the thing. I wish I knew, but I don't know how I would feel about that situation because I haven't encountered it yet.
War Machine, I mean, a lot of stuff that drops on Netflix automatically creates buzz, but I mean, I made a list of some of the Netflix movies to be released, and you have War Machine, you have Okja, those are the kind of the two recent ones, but you also have Crouching Tiger, the Hidden Dragon sequel, which kind of came and went. I mean, it's still on Netflix, of course, but how many people did you hear talk about the Crouching Tiger? Meanwhile, on Amazon, that 90-day model you're talking about, you had Cafe Society, The Big Sick, The Neon Demon, Patterson, Manchester by the Sea, which are all movies you hear talked about.
Yeah, the Neon Demon, I think, is an interesting film because it struck me as one of those ones where the streaming model or the kind of outside of studio model made a lot of sense. You can take or leave that movie. I didn't love it as because I felt it was one of those cases where a director just gets way too much freedom and decides to like that he's just going to make a movie where he plays around with actresses like dolls. But the thing
not invalid.
The thing about Netflix though is that I think what I can imagine why they'd be hunting somebody like Christopher Nolan and why they were hunting Martin Scorsese is probably because, you know, you see Interstellar on Netflix, you know, it's always really high up the queue of like, oh, you might like this. That Netflix to me is such a calculated enterprise. Netflix is they want to and what bothers me a little bit about Netflix's model, at least in television, the film actually seems like it's to be determined, is that they front load it. They really like put out a bunch of things which seem really great, and then it seems like with the Netflix television, for you know, every you know first season of House of Cards, there's a million like there's so many bad Netflix originals now. And really the only Netflix made film I know about, really, although apparently it's one of their highest streaming things, is The Ridiculous Six.
The Sandler one,
Adam Sandler one. Which I wouldn't watch it, but it's gotten really good numbers because people love Sandler. But so
that's out of people love Sandler. I'm not sure if people love it's I don't know, it's debatable.
Well, what let me ask you what you think of that 90-day model.
Yeah.
What do you think of, like, does it bother you that Netflix original movies may not play theatrically?
For some, it would. I think I would be disappointed if I couldn't see The Irishman theatrically.
Right. That's where I always find myself falling. It's like, well, it depends what movie it is. You know what I mean? Would I be upset if Lawrence of Arabia went straight to Netflix? Yeah, kind of, without going to theater. But would
kind
I be...
Kind of a bad example, but...
Sure. Okay, Manchester by the Sea. Right, would I be upset if I didn't see Manchester by the Sea in theaters and I saw it for the first time on Amazon or a streaming service? Not really.
Mm.
I don't think so.
I mean, that's a good question, is scale, too. And I think one of the interesting tests will be there's a movie called Bright coming up that's being released in December on Netflix. And
is that the David Ayer?
Yeah.
Right.
But it's like it's a police drama with like gleep globs and fairies and goblins and other things all living in like – it's basically like what if modern day L.A. was Dungeons and Dragons land. And they just released a trailer for it, and it looks like a typical summer fantasy action blockbuster. And how is that going to play? Are people going to rush to their Netflix queues to see it? If they are going to rush to their Netflix queues to see it, because they might see it, maybe see a trailer online and go, "Oh, where are you going to get that?" And maybe not see the commercials on TV or no trailers in the movie theater. Or are people actually maybe going to seek it out because it's going to be a big visual experience? It's an action movie. I mean, that's going to be an interesting case, I think.
Well, it's like you were saying, like a movie like Okja is not like...
Right.
Is there a benefit to releasing that in theaters, like a wide release? I don't think people would be rushing. It's a pretty obscure movie. I don't think people would be rushing to see that. So it really depends, I think. But I am... it kind of surprises me, like, how hostile he is about Netflix. Like, I would at least be open-minded, I would say. Mm. If someone asked me and I felt the same way, I would at least say, you know, if they changed up their model and then we could talk about certain things. Or if we had the right project, then, you know, in the circumstances, we're right. But he straight up just said, like, well, you know, I'm doing the theatrical thing, so there's no point.
Yeah.
Yeah, he in fact said, "Why would anyone want to be on Netflix?" Although I would say I'm not surprised that Christopher Nolan in particular said that. I think that he's resisted digital so stringently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he is somebody who I almost wonder if he's like coming from that old like film theory background of like the theater as a metaphor for like, you know, the lights darken and you're really being taken into a new experience. There's people who get very, very in depth of like, you know, the ontology of film.
Right.
So that strikes me as the place he's coming from, is that there is something quite unique about seeing something in a theater that is an experience. And if you watch that on your phone, you're not even really watching my film. There's a great David Lynch clip, which we can't play all because of the cut swear words. But
well, speaking of clips we can play, we'll take a break here and then come back with our review of that new Christopher Nolan movie, Dunkirk, which I think is definitely a film you don't want to wait to see on Netflix. Before that, though, we are going to play a ditty by Delirium with Emily Haynes. It is called Stopwatch Hearts, and I think you will find that very significant. And it's from the 2015 album, Rarities and B-Sides. And as for us, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
We have to go to Dunkirk. Ready on the stern line.
What are you doing? You know where we're going.
Into war, George.
I'll be useful, sir.
One of ours.
He's on me.
I'm on him.
The ship's about to leave.
Down you go.
They need to send more ships.
Every hour, the enemy pushes closer.
They've activated the civilian boats.
Civilians? We need destroyers.
Where are we going?
Dunkirk!
I'm not going back.
If we go, they will die.
You're
weekend sailors, not the bloody Navy.
You should be at home.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
Turn it around!
They did not turn it around. Spoiler alert. That is a scene from Dunkirk. It is the new movie by Christopher Nolan. It stars Tom Hardy, Mark Rylance, Cillian Murphy, Harry Styles, James Darcy, and Kenneth Branagh. Why don't we just get right into it? Because you were talking about going to a party after seeing this.
Yeah.
And what was the word you used?
The word I would use is bleak. It's a really engaging movie, but it is, you don't, there's no real rah, rah, rah sense to it. It is bleak from start to finish, basically.
What do you think?
Well, I
stymied.
Yeah, like in a good way though. Like this movie, like blew me away. Honestly, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And one of the things that really I admired about it was the structure of it. Actually, I found that it's very kind of nonlinear, and Christopher Nolan generally has these very likes to play around with structure.
Yeah.
And chronology a lot. And so it essentially follows three different kind of characters, basically from the land, air, and sea, if that's fair to say. And the way it kind of interweaves all of it, I found just really incredibly skillful, just skillfully done as a filmmaker. Some of his stuff, I was reading about some of his comments about Netflix just prior to seeing this film, and it kind of bothered me, and I had to admit that it was just an incredible movie. Mm. There, I would be hard-pressed to find anybody that could not find something, I think, about this that they could enjoy.
Yeah, you don't realize the time crunch of it until it's later in the movie where you sort of see the timelines line up.
Yeah,
that was a great moment.
Yeah, that was great. And, you know, because I think in real life it took the civilian ships they sent to evacuate the troops. I think it took them like a week to get there because of the seas or at least a couple of days. And because they weren't fast ships, they were little civilian tugs. And meanwhile, the action on the beach, and you get the flying time for the pilots was like an hour. Yeah, they had an hour of fuel to get over there, shoot down some German planes, and then get back. Enjoy is the wrong word, but I was very engrossed by it. I'm not sure if it's maybe his best work, but what I did appreciate was is Christopher Nolan's, I don't know if it's his central thesis as a filmmaker, but it's certainly a recurring thing where he just kind of throws you in and he just says, you know what, this is happening, try and keep up, and sort of takes you through it. There's really no kind of explanation at the beginning of, you know, how this all started or why there are 400,000 British troops stuck on the beach. Or the logistical concerns and trying to get them off the beach. It's just like here's the first character we're introduced to, who is with his troop, and they're kind of it's kind of unsettling when it opens because they're standing in an empty street and they're having propaganda dropped on them with the Germans saying, oh, you're surrounded, hey, give up, and then it immediately starts with an action sequence where they're being, you know, shot at by snipers, and it goes right into the beach, and then you see the whole scope of what's going on, and it just immediately sets a tone, and I do understand the bleakness, but I mean, frankly, this was kind of the bleakest moment of World War II.
Yeah, I with that first scene, I remember feeling right off the top the sounds of this movie. I found really impressive.
Oh, the sound is
the
like
sound design
incredible.
Is excellent. Yeah,
something about the way the crack of the rifles and the machine guns. It's just it's not like anything I've heard in a war movie before. There's usually this kind of generic da 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 da, but this everything sounds. You know, from the difference between the nose gun of a Spitfire to the rear gun of a bomber, like just those little details felt really, really important. It really brings you into the world.
Yeah, one of the things and one of the reasons why the song I chose was Stopwatch Hearts. I was just looking for a song with Stopwatch on the title, but the Stopwatch sound effect, it's so pervasive in the movie. It's almost like the Jaws theme, because things will get all quiet and then you hear the stopwatch and you hear the tick, 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 and you know something bad is about to go down, that they're about, that the whole effort to save these men is about to take a left turn. And then it's usually after that you hear the tick, 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 and you hear the of the plane coming in. And sometimes you don't even hear it right away. There's a scene where Kenneth Branagh, who's an admiral, he's admiral, but he's on the beach sort of trying to marshal getting the men off, and he just kind of looks up, and you're like, what's he looking? And then you hear it. And the sound design is incredible.
He must have spoken to people who described the same thing, you know, the terror of hearing that kind of that plane in the distance.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, I found myself most captivated by like the dogfights and the airplane sequences. I have never seen like air warfare depicted like that. I just found it so so engaging. It was so well done. You don't even really see Tom Hardy's face that much in it. It's just covered by the plane mask. Yeah, and he's mostly just kind of maneuvering in the cockpit for most of the movie. But it's so well done.
Did you ever see Locke?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Actually, that's actually a very nice segue.
I'm just saying that Tom Hardy has experience in enclosed spaces.
True.
He's kind of like, he kind of looks like a fighter jock. He kind of looks believable as a fighter jock figure. But I mean, there's nothing physical about the performance other than like turning his head around. It's all kind of within the cockpit, and the cockpit is so tight because these are planes that are just meant for fighting. They're not meant for comfort. They're meant to like get you into the battle. The dogfights, I'm not sure how original. I mean, I think there's only so much you can do with dogfights, but I think one of the things that it did well was showing like it's not all, you know, you get on your target and you shoot him down, you move on to the next one. It's sometimes you're chasing a guy for several minutes, and sometimes he shoots down your wingman, and it's not as easy as, you know, other movies have sort of made it look, you know, Hell on Wings and other things. I don't know if that's a real movie, if I just made that up, but
I don't know.
Hellfighters or something, but one of those movies.
Yeah, there was an exploitation film in the 70s called that, probably. I don't know. And there's a scene at the end, actually, when he's about to land the plane, and I guess there's some sort of stick or something that you have to crank, and you have to manually crank those wheels
for the landing gear.
Yeah, as opposed to like, you know, whatever million other things, you just press the button and they kind of eject or have that mechanical squeak to them.
Oh, it's great at making you realize how complicated it is, because his fuel gauge gets.
And he's got to write it physically, like in chalk on the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, the crudity of the instruments and even even the sights, you know, you keep thinking, come on, he got him, right? He got him. Because he'll be firing, and you'll think that it's within the, you know, acceptable range or whatever, but then it'll miss it, and he'll have to go for another pass. And he does a really good way of building tension with the misses.
Yeah. If there is one kind of complaint that I have, it's that, and this isn't really a complaint, it's more of my personal bias, but I would have liked to have seen, I think, the characters just fleshed out a little bit more. I understand why he did it the way he did it. It does really give you that you're dropped in there kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just my personal taste in movies, I like to have, you know, characters that you can kind of follow that have their own arcs and whatnot. But I'm almost glad he didn't do that, so it didn't kind of turn into that sappy, those kind of tropes that war movies fall into sometimes.
Yeah, I think that would undermine the bleakness, as you were saying. True. If you get to know somebody who has like three brothers and blah, blah, blah. It also sort of adds to the sort of the desperation of this that you're kind of thrown into, because the character, I can't remember his name, but it's Fionn Whitefield, I think the actor's name is. He is with his squad at the beginning, but he's the only one that survives after the sniper fire. He's onto this beach and he's surrounded by a ton of people who, you know, he doesn't know, but he has this large group of allied soldiers, and you know, you're probably just thrown into this situation where everybody's just waiting. And you know, I have a feeling it's probably a situation where you probably didn't pass the time getting to know people.
And it is a bleak film, but I have found it also kind of uplifting to know that civilians would come and do something like that as well.
Well, I mean, not to get into too much wonkish history stuff, but I mean, that is one of the things about World War II, is that the Allies were able to galvanize civilian resources better than the Germans were.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
You did look like you had something to say.
There's something about the film. I had a thought somewhere in the middle,
right,
where it's almost like the anti Saving Private Ryan, because they're always heading toward the beaches and just kind of getting brought back, and like, you know, there's kind of the kind of quiet character who, you know, like the people you really want to be saved. I don't want to spoil anything, but that's what I found was so bleak about it, is that you really, almost in a way, that the lack of arc of the characters is that there really is this sense of like, yeah, it's just luck of the draw which decides whether or not you are going to make it through this evacuation.
Yeah, definitely. Very interesting little subplot with like Cillian Murphy and Mark Rylance and whatnot. That I thought was going somewhere, but didn't go where I thought it was going to go.
Yeah.
But it was probably, I realized after, it was probably a true story. Like
it might have been
something that he might have read about or something.
It might have been. This is kind of an anti-war film in that respect, because most war films are about a victory, even if at the end, you know, like Private Ryan, like Dirty Dozen, you know, where most of the people you've come to know are killed in action.
Mm-hmm.
This is not about a traditional military victory, and it was in the end it's sort of danced around, but even though they don't address Churchill directly, that he turned it into a victory. It's like, yeah, we survived, we got all our men back, and now we're ready to strike back, you know, at the Germans and at any time we feel like it, and now we have to sort of bolster the homeland. But I mean, aside from that, just, you know, a mass retreat, not typically a military victory.
And I think that's what also Churchill was talking about as well.
Yeah, they read his speech and
although,
interestingly, I think, did they play the trailer for The Darkest Hour before you guys saw it, the Gary Oldman Churchill movie?
Yes, yeah.
Because that sort of feels like a companion piece to this, because it's about the political stuff and the bunker and the evacuation and getting ready for the Germans coming over the channel.
That's true, yeah.
So that was I don't know if they did that on purpose or...
Somehow Justice League also fits into there somehow, I don't know.
Also preparing for an invasion?
Yeah, exactly.
where was Aquaman during World War II?
don't give them any ideas, okay? Oh, they'll make that movie, like they will.
They might. the Cillian Murphy, yeah, that storyline. I mean, Mark Rylance is such a great actor.
Yep.
You know, I loved him, and I think he was the best part of Bridge of Spies, and I think he's one of the best parts here, because he there's so much going on to look at him, and just the look on his face and everything that's going on.
So he's traveling to Dunkirk with his two young boys.
Well, one's his son and one's his son's friend.
Right, yes,
yeah.
Sorry.
So
you follow them for a bit, and they...
Yeah, and they pick up Cillian Murphy. But, right. I mean, that's another sort of untraditional aspect, because in typical movies, this character would be given some kind of arc to redemption, and we don't really see that here. And there's another character in it who is a French soldier who we first see sort of burying a British soldier, but not in his uniform. And it takes you a minute to sort of pick up what's going on.
Yeah.
And to understand what's that, but I mean, this is sort of not a I mean, incidentally, it's a story about heroes, but it's not a story of heroes. It's a story of just like straight up survival, and it looks like literally live to fight another day, which is again a very untraditional war film kind of plot.
The mole segment, which is the land part, yep. It particularly had that aspect of non-heroism because you know they're picking up a stretcher, sure, but they are doing that so that they can get on a ship, get the hell away from there.
Yeah.
And then they climb into sort of the rigging of the wharf, hoping to get onto the next ship early. Like they're not being.
Yeah, they're not subtle.
Exciting heroes. They are trying to survive.
Which, when the British rescue boats are coming around, guys are literally in the water with life jackets, and they're like, okay, get away from the boat. We're going to come back from you or for you.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine people doing that. I would just be devastated. But
and then, it ends up the tide takes them back to the beach. and there's this great scene where they're all kind of like sitting there, and this is another great aspect, is just like this is not a fun time at the beach. This is not great beach weather. It's like there's like the wet sand, the foam, the dust, and the blowing wind, and they're all kind of sitting there in this like awful weather. And you know, you see this one soldier who gets up and walks towards the water and starts taking off his ammo and his helmet and just walks into the tide. And that's such a powerful moment. It's just, you know, it says so much, even though nothing is said in that scene.
There's very little dialogue actually for the first little bit.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is very visual. Which is, it's really, and it makes it even more powerful, I think. Plus, with the sound design, it gets to the end where you hear the stopwatch, and you hear it stop, and you're like, "Oh God, what's going to happen?" Even though it's at the end, and it's brilliantly paced too.
Sorry, that was a guy next to me with a stopwatch. He just clicked it. I don't know why you had it,
but it's brilliantly paced too. Because it's one of Nolan's shortest films.
Yeah.
It's like an hour and 40 minutes. But it gets to like about half an hour before it's over, and you're still not entirely sure how, like, everyone's still on the beach at that point, and they can't get any boats in, and because they get sunk by U-boats or bombed by German fighters, and you're kind of looking at the time, you're looking at the screen, saying, I mean, you know, in the back of your head, they get out, but in terms of watching it on film, you don't know how it's going to get done.
It says something about the skill of that film that it's able to do that.
Absolutely. Is this going to be an awards contender, you think?
For sound, I don't see how it couldn't either win or be nominated for an Oscar for sound.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't say. I would say yes. If I was on the Academy, I would nominate it for Best Picture, or I would vote to have it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to get nominations. I don't know if it's going to be the film that wins a bunch of things. I could see it winning.
Yeah.
If it wins thing, I could see it being like filmography, but more technical than narrative awards.
Yeah, yeah. The editing was really nice.
Yeah,
the music was really nice.
Yeah.
What about you? Do you think it's an awards contender?
I think it'll finish. I can see it getting a Best Picture because it's Nolan, because it's a war movie.
Yeah.
Best Director nomination for him?
That's a good question. I think, again, I don't think it's his best. I think Inception probably stands as his best film, but I don't know. It's tricky.
Tonally, it felt very very different from.
Oh yeah, and it's very different from what he usually does. Even though, I mean, he has Tom Hardy and Cillian Murphy, who are like two of his sort of rep players.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like a Chris Nolan movie. I think it's going to depend on what all comes out in the fall, whether he gets Best Director.
Yeah,
I think, and I think it might be one of these situations where they kind of take in, as you said, his filmography as a whole. It's like, well, Christopher Nolan has kind of been this close before with Inception and The Dark Knight and Interstellar and Memento. So, you know, it might be one of those occasions. But, I mean, we'll have to see how the rest of the year plays out. Anyway, that is our review of Dunkirk, and you can see it now in theaters. You might want to go check it out now, because this is the end of End Credits for this week, and we hope you liked it, and it will be available to be heard again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also find us on social media at End Credits Radio Show on the Facebook and End Credits Radio on the Twitter. Guys, it's been such a great time having
you
guys in.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Ian, since you are the guest, you can talk to the people and tell them where you can find more of your work and learn more about you.
Well, I have recently started up an attempt at a podcast called In Defense Of. I've only put out one episode, but you can find that on soundcloud.com/in. Just search for In Defense Of, but defense with the Canadian spelling with a C. It's a pop culture show where we take things that haven't been given quite a fair shake in the general zeitgeist and give a passionate, impassioned defense of them.
I actually love that idea.
Sounds great. Vince?
If you just Google Ryan Gosling, you'll be able to find... No, you can find me on Facebook, Vincent Masson, or Twitter.
Or you can get him through Ryan Gosling.
Yeah. exactly.
I write about movies, TV show, and other nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com, and I'll be back here later today at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Source's Guelph with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Thursday morning at 10 a.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.